You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Friday, April 6th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. It is not casual Friday. It is, in fact, sort of like uncasual Friday. For today, I am celebrating the beginning of Passover and also the beginning of my daughter's spring vacation. However, on the program today, we have for you Darren Acemoglu, author of the new book, Why Nations Fail. Pre-recorded earlier this week, but you're going to love it. It's all new to you. You will enjoy it. And for our members in the bonus round, we'll have Aaron Smith of the Young Invincibles. Young people advocating for more and better health care, who I spoke to during the Supreme Court arguments as to the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. As we speak, I am undoubtedly in a vehicle right now with my daughter, who is probably complaining that she's been in the car for too long. And I am trying to maintain my patience with her as we drive to my family's house somewhere in the luxurious town of Worcester, Massachusetts. Ladies and gentlemen, please enjoy the program. First up, we will have Darren Acemoglu, the author of the Why Nations Fail. He is an economist from MIT. Fascinating stuff. Here's a little clue. Our nation may just be failing. And why? Well, of course, it is because of the tremendous income disparity and what that does to our political system. It's something that, we've been talking about on this program for over a year, year and a half now, since its inception. And something that has been brought more into national attention with the Occupy movement. So let's hear that. And then members, stick around. You will hear an interview with Aaron Smith of the Young Invincibles. And make sure you tune in next week. We've got some great interviews with economist Robert Frank, with writer Thomas Frank. That's all we're going to do for the Franks at that point. We're going to be talking to Jessica Valenti on her latest book and movie, The Purity Myth. We'll be talking to Congressman Keith Ellison next week. We'll be talking to, just a whole raft of people I know you're going to enjoy. So stick around for this, and we'll see you later.
I turn my camera on. I cut my fingers on.
On the phone, a professor of applied economics at MIT and a member of the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research Program on Institutions, Organizations, and Growth, Darren Acemoglu is with us, and he is also the author with James Robinson of Why Nations Fail, The Origins of Power, Prosperity, and Poverty. Welcome to the program, Darren.
Thanks, Sam. I'm very happy to be here.
Now, when I first heard of your book, I immediately thought of Collapse by Jared Diamond, which came out, I guess, 4, 5, 6 years ago. And how would you characterize Why Nations Fail in relationship to Jared Diamond's Collapse?
Jared's Collapse is a wonderful book that follows on his even more famous and even more spectacular book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, and tackles a range of very important questions related to societal collapse. But the distinguishing feature, characteristic of our book, is that we depart quite sharply from many of the most popular views in the academic literature and in the public debates about what are the sources of economic failure. And Jared's is an example, a very sophisticated example of what you could characterize as geographic explanations that emphasize such things as climate, soil type, soil quality, and so on. And that was the sort of explanation that he developed in Guns, Germs, and Steel for how some societies developed earlier into more complex forms, and that's why the Europeans were the ones that went around the world and conquering the rest and not the Incas or the Aztecs. And Collapse sort of follows on in the same sort of intellectual tradition, but also brings very interesting ideas of how societies can take actions to sort of stem ecological degradation, and when they don't do so, how this will lead to different types of collapse in societies. You know, our perspective is very different in that we emphasize, you know, the politics of it. So to us, economic failure, the reason why nations fail to realize their economic potential, is all about institutions. They do not create institutions that encourage innovation and investment. They do not create institutions that create a level playing field that deploys the talent of their citizens. And the reason they don't do this is political. Political power is in the hands of people who benefit from creating opposite types of institutions, what we call extractive institutions, that are used for extracting resources by the elite, by the few, from the many. And those are not encouraging to economic growth in general.
And so you go through you use some concrete examples of this, and some countries almost function as, or I guess regions, because when you're talking specifically in terms of geography or culture, which is I guess the other sort of most prominent academic explanation for the disparity of functioning, I guess, of nations. Have I characterized that properly?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So I just mentioned the geographic explanation because of Jared Diamond connection, but actually the one that's even more popular would be a cultural explanations, which would claim that, you know, societies are poor because of certain cultural values or beliefs or practices. So, you know, it would go that Haitians are poor because of their some sort of Haitian values that are inimical to growth, or Africans are poor because of some African values, or Latin Americans are not as prosperous as North Americans because of some Spanish values. So these go back to Max Weber, for example, in his famous book, in which he advanced the hypothesis that the Protestant ethic was crucial for the development of markets. And And we sort of go through the a variety of examples and evidence in the book to dispel the notion that these cultural attitudes are really crucial for understanding what goes on. And I think, you know, some of the examples we give are very easy to grasp. And if I can mention it in just 1 second, you know, you can look in societies that have the same geography, same culture, very homogeneous societies, but they get divided by a border into two. And then different sides of the border get different institutions, different incentives supported by different political systems. And then you see big economic divergences, even though they have the same culture, even though they say they have the same geography. You know, the example that probably was very familiar to people would be something like South Korea versus North Korea, a very ethnically, linguistically, economically, culturally homogeneous society gets divided into two, and then over the next 60 years, over the 60 years since that event happened, you know, you see a huge divergence. You know, South Korea is now over tenfold as rich as North Korea on a per capita basis. Or you can take, you know, many of the border towns between the United States and Mexico. We talk about Nogales, a small little town that's divided into two by the U.S.-Mexican border. Part of it is in Arizona, and the other part is in Mexico, Sonora, so Mexican state Sonora. And, you know, same people, same cultural practices, same geography, but you have very different economic outcomes because, you know, one part of it is under U.S. institutions and one part of it is under Mexican institutions.
Let's turn to if we can to go back to the Koreans. I mean, I think most people are familiar that in North Korea is if not one of the I guess one of the most sort of. I don't know how you would characterize it in the spectrum.
One of the worst regimes. Yes, one of the worst regimes. Definitely, you should feel free to call them.
Well,
and
no,
what's nice about
regime,
North Korea is that.
I mean, in terms of like their economic status, I don't know where they would sit. I mean, obviously, I mean.
Oh yeah, they are. You know, they are. That's the thing. North Korea, you know, is almost as poor as the poorest nations in the world. It's got levels of income, you know, close to the average of sub-Saharan Africa. Countries, you know, ravaged by civil war, and North Korea is in there, and you know, it has had several famines and. And the nice thing about North Korea is that it's an enemy of the United States, so we are totally free to sort of call them for exactly what they are.
Yeah. Well, and so now, how is it that South Korea? I mean, do you address the question of how it is? I mean, I want to get into the notion specifically about these institutions that promote a better economy, I guess, and I want to get into how you define that. But
Sure, yes, that's quite crucial, yes, absolutely.
But before that question, what is it possible that the institutions that you speak of that create this better economy, in terms of South Korea, is it possible that in some way the Western cultural values or because of Western intervention in some fashion has created and changed the cultural differences, or is it simply that they introduced South Korea to institutions? How does that happen?
Well, of course, nothing exists in a vacuum. You know, both North Korea and South Korea exist in a world society, in a world order. And, you know, South Korea aligned itself with the United States and NATO. And North Korea, you know, was a client state of, you know, Russia and then and China. So there obviously were influences in those directions. But I think it would be hard to say that in any way, you know, the U.S. imposed its cultural values on South Korea. Of course, today, if you look at the sort of cultural values in South Korea, they are different than those in North Korea. But that's an outcome. So, for instance, you know, Barbara Demnig has a very nice book that came out last year on Nothing to Envy About, which is about the lives in North Korea, and it sort of describes the details. And, you know, everything is different now in North Korea after 60 years of repression. For example, people don't date. There is no dating. Why is that? Is that because people have different cultural values? But not really. It's mostly because that's sort of the repressive state even doesn't even permit dating. So that's sort of almost regulated. So people start internalizing those, and you see some sort of different values, different cultural attitudes develop. But it's mostly because of a stiflingly repressive environment that's in North Korea.
All right. So talk about the type of institutions, or better yet, let's start with what is the definition of a better economy in this sense.
That's also a very good question. Different people would define a better economy differently. So we focus on one slice of that. We focus on economic prosperity. There's no sort of there's no widespread agreement that that's the only thing you should focus on, and nor do we argue that. But it's clear that when you are talking about the sort of differences that we observe at the moment, those are serious things to be reckoned with. So, you know, if you take an economy like the United States or Germany or Japan or South Korea, you know, they are about 40 times as rich as some of the poorest countries in the world, such as, you know, Ethiopia, Somalia, Haiti, and so on. So, so those are really huge differences, and it means that the poor countries are unable to provide a decent living. Health conditions are awful. People are children are starving, and so on. So that's the thing where we focus on. And so a good society in that sense for us is one that is able to take advantage of the opportunities to prosper. So that is able to generate income for its citizens.
So, like, specifically, like, what are the indexes you look at to measure prosperity? I mean, you know, we have is it simply something like the GDP, or is it
GDP per capita would be the one that one would focus on. But it's if you look at something like life expectancy, which is an outcome of GDP per capita, you'll see that's pretty similar. Average life expectancy is much lower in North Korea than South Korea. It's much lower in south of the border in Mexico than in north of the border in the United States, for example.
I ask only because I think one of the things we're struggling with in this country on some level is how we measure prosperity, how we measure prosperity in the context of we have growing income disparity in this country, and at what point do we hit a moment where we say, despite the fact that we have a tremendous amount of GDP, it's not being shared in the amongst the people in the same way that it was, let's say, 30 years ago. So, I mean, I'm asking.
That's a very important question, and it's one that I think has a lot of relevance for the U.S. context. That's something we don't, we don't directly dwell on, but it's something that we indirectly talk about. And the reason why we talk indirectly to talk about, and let me sort of quickly bring the U.S. context. We haven't totally explained the thesis, but I think the U.S. context will help us explain the thesis a little more clearly. If you look at the U.S. data, it's exactly what you've mentioned. In the United States, if you look at median household income over the last 35 years, almost 40 years, it hasn't increased all that much. It's it would not be an exaggeration to say it's essentially flat. So that's tremendous. U.S. economy has been growing almost at 2% a year, but the median income hasn't budged. If you look at other measures of inequality, they have skyrocketed. So the one that the Occupy Wall Street movement has sort of shunned the spotlight on. The share of the top 1%. That has sort of increased from about 10-12% of national income to almost 25% of national income. So that's a huge increase. You know, the richest 1% earn almost a quarter of all national income in the United States. So those sort of inequalities are quite consequential. And but it would be sort of to some degree it's a value judgment. You know, if you go and talk to people to the average American, some of them will say, you know, that's a tragedy, and that, you know, yeah, we have to deal with that. And some others will say, you know, look, I think the top 1% are more productive. They are right. They are the ones that are producing it, and I don't see any problem with it. So there's some value judgment on how much you should be worried about inequality. Right. But what we say is that there is another aspect of inequality which I think requires much less value judgment, and that is that if you have economic inequality, it very easily spills into political inequality. And that's exactly what's been happening in the United States. And when I said the story that we tell, the theory that we develop is mostly about politics, it's because, you know, what sorts of institutions you have, whether those institutions create a level playing field for the whole society or look after the interest of a very select few, that's a political decision. And what's been happening in the United States very much over the last 30 years, but even more so perhaps over the last 10 years, is that the very wealthy have been becoming politically much more powerful. That's not just because of super PACs. Of course, super PACs contribute to it, but that's the tip of the iceberg. You know, we have lobbying, campaign contributions, just the general alignment of parties with their wealthy constituents for a variety of reasons means that so the average American is losing its political voice, and the very wealthy, the business elite is becoming more and more influential in what sorts of questions are in the political agenda, what sort of policies are being taken. And that is where the institutions risk becoming starting to change in a more extractive direction from the typically inclusive institutions that United States has had for quite a long time.
And that's the heart of your thesis, is that you must have institutions that are sensitive to the needs of the broadest base possible. Is that a fair?
Exactly. So exactly, and that's and let me put it slightly differently. For economic growth, it's really important that the institutions, the economic institutions, are inclusive in the sense that they create incentives for investment and innovation, and they create a level playing field where people, regardless of whether they are the sons or daughters of Bill Gates or Rockefeller or Vanderbilt, they can go far in life and use their talent and use their opportunity, use their talent and use their skills. But those sorts of inclusive economic institutions are pretty much impossible unless there is political equality. In other words, unless there is an inclusive set of political institutions. And what the United States has pretty much managed to maintain with some ups and downs over the last 200 years is a fairly inclusive set of institutions. And what's the risk today is that with the increase in inequality spilling into political inequality, so that the inclusive political institutions become more extractive, and once that happens, the level playing field and those incentives for the Americans at large start disappearing.
All right, so let's back up and we'll circle back around to what's happening in this country, because let's talk about how it is that some countries end up having these type of institutions that that provide prosperity and provide political input from enough sectors of society that it provides a, I guess, to a certain extent, broad-based prosperity in your work, at least in terms of a value judgment, but it provides more prosperity. How is it that some societies develop those institutions and others don't?
I think that's an excellent question because, you know, at the bottom of it is that, you know, at first it appears like a paradox. You know, why would it be that a society would choose institutions that doesn't encourage prosperity? You know, why would any society not want prosperity? And the answer is very simple, because, you know, the people who are calling the shots, who have the political power, who are making the key policy and institutional decisions in society, don't represent the entire society. They represent themselves. They might be business leaders who want their who care about their own bottom line. There could be politicians who want to line their pockets, or there could be simply politicians who want to hang on to power at whatever cost for the society that might entail. So if you are in a situation like that, it's very easy to see why extractive institutions will emerge, and moreover, why they will persist. But then that brings the $1 million question. So once you are under extractive institutions, and throughout history, almost every society started out with extractive institutions, and that's been the historical norm, inclusive institutions being the exception. So how did many of them, or some of them, break out of that and start developing inclusive institutions? So that's that takes up quite a bit of the book. That's why we have a historical perspective in the book, is we try to go back in history and try to develop a satisfactory answer to this question. And at the bottom of it, and I'll give some examples, but at the bottom of it, there are two paths. One path is that it can happen in a very radical way, with some sort of a revolution, like the French Revolution in 1789, or like the Arab Spring that brought down, you know, governments in Tunisia, Egypt, Libya. Or it can happen in a more gradual manner, like, for example, in England. But in both cases, it doesn't happen without conflict. In both cases, it doesn't happen because the elites suddenly say, ah, well, we would like to grant rights to people so that the life becomes better for them. It typically happens because people demand more rights, and the elites decide to either accommodate those in a peaceful and gradual manner, or decide to fight them. And when they fight them, you know, sometimes they win, and sometimes they lose, leading to truly transformative revolutions.
And by extractive, I mean, I think hopefully people understand that, but it's essentially where you use the resources of society, and instead of sort of setting up institutions that sort of reinvest it back into society in the form of education, in the form of infrastructure, in the form of health care, it's actually you just basically suck it out and enrich yourself.
Yes, absolutely. So, and you know, I think the sort of the defining characteristics, you know, because we've been sort of we have a fairly large scope in the book, and we've been discussing, you know, various different parts of the book. So, but if we go back to the beginning, you know, James and I defined inclusive institutions as those that create incentives for innovation and investment in a level playing field, and the extractive institutions to be the opposite. So if you want to think about those extractive economic institutions, the examples abound around us. So, for instance, look at Uzbekistan today. You know, children go to school in Uzbekistan, but they don't actually learn anything. They are then shipped to cotton fields where they work as, you know, free forced laborers to pick cotton. So that's their school life. And, you know, that's an extractive institution. Why? Because the vast majority of children in Uzbekistan are not learning anything. They're not getting any education, even if they are as skilled as a Bill Gates or Steve Jobs or Larry Page. They're not going to achieve their calling in life because they're not learning anything. Instead, they're just picking cotton so that the elite in Uzbekistan, Ismail Karimov and his family and the cronies surrounding him, can make a lot of money without loosening their grip they have on power. For example, we give examples from Europe in the 19th century and medieval ages. We go through several inventions that are important, you know, ranging from different sorts of steam engines to textile machines to railways, factories. And all of these great innovations that in other contexts have been transformative have been blocked by elites. You know, the Austria-Hungarian Empire, the Russian Empire, before the Glorious Revolution and the transformation of society, even the English monarchs essentially stopped the implementation of these ideas. Why? Not because these ideas were bad or would not enrich society. They would enrich society, but they were afraid that these ideas and their implementation would weaken their grip on power. So those are, again, examples of extractive institutions.
Now, when you talk about how these situations change, and you talk about revolutions, you cite the French Revolution. I mean, on some level, it occurs to me that arguably the New Deal was a sort of a mini revolution in that respect, that you had people in this country who said, you know, we're living, there's a widespread poverty, there's, you know, lack of labor regulations, or, you know, you have so many of our elderly are living on in poverty, that Social Security in some respects was sort of was in some ways inclusive.
Well, I think the New Deal is complicated. I mean, I think New Deal did a lot of good things and even more bad things. So I think you know, you really need to look at the details of the New Deal, because it really increased the coercive power of the state in some very bad directions as well. FDR adopted really some awful economic policies and also some awful policies towards the Supreme Court, for example, trying to take away the independence of the judiciary. The example we give in the book of the U.S. really taking a huge step towards inclusive institutions is the progressive movement. So if you look at the, you know, that's the best parallel for the problems that we're having today. The Gilded Age was very similar to the events today. Inequality was very high, both income inequality and wealth inequality. There were some businessmen, you know, Rockefeller, Cornelius Vanderbilt, Carnegie, who had huge trust monopolies that were economically powerful, but also politically hugely powerful. They had senators in their pocket. The Senate was not elected. There was no income tax. There was no way of breaking the power of the trusts. But what happened was that instead of lying down and taking these things as just a matter of fact or fact of life, the U.S. people, you know, first formed a sort of populist movement that forced the government to take actions, and then they formed a progressive movement, which really influenced both the Democratic and the Republican parties, and brought to power, you know, three very important presidents, Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, William Taft, and Woodrow Wilson, who really transformed U.S. society by breaking the trust, increasing democracy, making the Senate elected, introducing the income tax, bringing, you know, things such as implementing the Sherman Act, bringing the Clayton Act. So that I think was a real watershed event for the U.S. history in bringing in institutions in a more inclusive direction. The other one I would mention that is almost as huge is the civil rights movement. So, you know, even with all of these things, you know, U.S. in the 1940s, 1950s was still not a fully inclusive society, because a very significant fraction of the people were not equal. So, you know, political equality means everybody, regardless of gender, creed, race, belief, should have political voice and should be treated equally, should have similar economic opportunities. And that certainly wasn't true for our African-American citizens. And that started being transformed in the 1950s with the civil rights movement. And what's important to note is that the civil rights movement is very similar to what happened in the aftermath of the Gilded Age with the progressive. It was again a grassroots movement that really forced itself on the agenda and created conflict, created movements, protests, sit-ins, and forced the political system to respond and change itself.
Now, I mean, here's the part that I'm a little bit confused about. If we and if you, you mentioned that, you know, certainly in the past 10 years we've had income disparity, and I think there's a study out of Princeton, and I forgive me, I can't remember the professor's name who did the study, but over the past 30 years or so, we have seen mm-hmm. that when we have political issues that that are particularly from an economic basis, but whenever there's type of political conflict, it is disproportionately resolved in favor of the wealthy, regardless of who.
Oh yeah, that's exactly the sort of pattern that I'm talking about. So the study you're talking about is by a political science professor at Princeton, Larry Bartels, and he doesn't actually. So the income inequality facts that I was citing, they are truly historical. They, you know, there's been work by scholars such as Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Saez from Berkeley, who have really done fantastic work using IRS records. So we know how income inequality has evolved over the last 100 years, the share of the top 1%, top 0.1%, or the top 5%. We know all of these things. Larry Bartels' study, unfortunately, is a single point in time. He only has data for a Senate in the mid-1990s. But what he finds is fascinating as well, fascinating and scary. So he looks at the views of senators and their views and their voting record, and compares them to those of their constituents. So people who are in their constituency, and he looks at it and he says he separates the people in the constituency into rich, middle, and poor. 30%, not top 1%, mind right. you, top 30%, middle 30%, bottom 30%, so more or less. And what he finds is that on a range of things, ranging from minimum wage, taxes, immigration, social policies, senators' votes are very strongly similar to the views of their wealthy top one-third of their constituents. And they are not correlated, not related, or sometimes even negatively related to the views of their bottom constituents.
And so that's where we see the income disparity at least turn into some type of political influence, and that's when we start
exactly.
to talk about
exactly.
the plutocracy. But
exactly.
But now, how is it possible? I mean, this is where I. How is it possible that if it is a function of institutions, what happens? What has happened to the institutions that has changed? I mean, if theoretically, we're talking about these changes that the progressive movement ushered in, and it liberalized these institutions in the sense that it allowed for a wider group of people to have influence on these decisions. What changed?
Well, you know, people became mobilized. You know, I think the most important thing is that, you know,
no, but
people
I'm saying,
like
what changed with these institutions? I mean, if
oh, what changed with the institutions? You know, well, you know, first of all, a given institution, a given constitution that's written on parchment paper, can work in a very different way. So that's the first thing that happened. So the first thing that happened is that, you know, the U.S. Constitution says the president will make the decisions, and, you know, and then the Congress, the Senate, they have legislative capacity. But what are they going to choose? So in the before 1890, there was really nothing that the Congress had done in order to combat the monopolization of the economy. After 1890, with the Sherman Act, and then after that with the Clayton Act, they passed key legislation that stopped the trusts dominating the economy. But the second thing that happened is that they started changing the institution. So, for example, the Senate was a hugely powerful body, but it wasn't elected. It was essentially senators were very much in the pockets of the very rich. So with the progressive era presidents campaigning for the direct election of the Senate, the senators changed their political positions, becoming much more responsive to the views of their constituents.
But what happened
so
between that time and the time that...
What happened between that time and now? That's a great question. I think nobody exactly knows, but a lot of people, including myself and Jim, James Robinson, my co-author, including Larry Bartels, whose work I just mentioned, suspect that it is very related to lobbying, that there has, you know, that the lobbying and campaign contribution, revolving door policies and all of these things have just started having a much bigger impact on politicians. Politicians, because of changes in the structure of elections, perhaps because of the importance of TV ads and other things, politicians started thinking, probably correctly, that they can't win elections unless they have a lot of money. And to get money, you need to be friendly and pander with the wealthy people who will give you money. And more importantly, you have to listen to lobbyists. And once you start listening to lobbyists, you know, you start internalizing their point of view and you start shifting your views in that direction. So if you look at some landmark legislation, such as the deregulation of the financial system that, you know, was, you know, not wholly but partly responsible for all of the financial problems that we had starting from 2007. You know, that was not a Republican versus Democrat issue. Both Republicans and Democrats went ahead with that because they were all getting a lot of money from financial lobbies. And I don't think they did it in a purely cynical manner. Some of them may have done it in a purely cynical manner, but many of them, you know, they kept talking to lobbyists from the financial industry. Why? Because these are the lobbyists who are going to give them millions of dollars for their election campaign. And the more they listened to them, the more they started internalizing and thinking, yes, you're right, it's very important that to get rid of all of these financial regulations so that our financial industry becomes even more dynamic. So it's a sort of a...
I'm not clear on how this is reconciled with your thesis that it's institutions, because, I mean... Theoretically, the institutions have not changed in that time, right? Or is it they simply have not adapted to the culture? I mean, because, I mean, we can say, like, for instance, I mean, we can say that FDR was in some way threatened the institution of the judiciary by using the threat of court packing, essentially,
yes,
to get these laws, like whether it's, you know, workers' rights laws or Social Security or whatever it is. But how did the institutions themselves change? There doesn't seem to be any change in the actual institutions of our government.
So that's that's one thing that we emphasize a lot in the book, but I didn't sort of emphasize at the beginning here. You know, when we talk of institutions, we don't simply mean what's written in the Constitution. We mean how those institutions actually function. So let me give you an example to illustrate exactly this point, and going back to the FDR court packing case. So actually, you know, what the FDR tried to do was really pack the court with people who were more friendly to his New Deal policies, because the Supreme Court justices were blocking some of the New Deal policies from being implemented. And the whole point of the judiciary was to act as a check on the president's power. But when FDR tried to do that, even though he had, you know, his party, the Democrats, had majority in both houses, he did not get the support to pack the court and essentially end, pretty much for good, the independence of the judiciary. So that's a place in which institutions functioned in a way that is quite distinctive. Now, lo and behold, the same thing happened in early 1950s in Argentina. Juan Perón also was trying to pass a couple of things, in particular trying to persecute some of his enemies, and the Supreme Court was standing in its on his way, in the same way that the Supreme Court in the United States was trying to stop what FDR was trying to do. And Juan Perón had exactly the same idea as the FDR, and he said, okay, fine, then I'm going to pack the court. And he had exactly remarkably similar arguments to FDR. He said, well, these justices are old, they're out of touch, they're too tired, having more justices would help, and so on and so forth. Nobody peeped, you know. Perón could do whatever he wanted. The Argentinian judiciary became a joke. Every president after him fired justices and replaced new ones, and the justices never were able to exercise any sort of check. But if you look at the constitutions, you know, the Argentine constitution is not that different from the U.S. constitution. But what we would say is that because the political power is distributed differently, the sort of political power that Juan Perón in Argentina as president was able to command, as, you know, allied with the military, you know, part of a military coup previously, was very different from the one that FDR was able to command. He was able to sort of use the Constitution in a very different way, and that is institutions functioning very differently. So that's the sense in which it's an institutional story.
What if I had posited that the Supreme Court was one of these dysfunctional institutions at that time, because it was basically there was a very narrow subset of people who could actually sit on the Supreme Court, and they came from such a narrow subset of people in this country that they weren't representing this notion of an open institution, of an inclusive institution.
Yeah, I think there's probably some truth to that as well. So I was definitely not trying to defend the views of the Supreme Court in the 1930s. But the more important part that I was trying to sort of formulate is how the capabilities of a president, which were supposed to be restricted in the Constitution, were in fact restricted in reality in the United States, but the Constitution didn't mean anything in Argentina.
Right.
Now, of course, if a president is really popular and is trying to implement a very popular mandate, and it's the only a couple of people in the Supreme Court who are against it, one way or another, you know, there will be changes to do that. In fact, you know, the policies that FDR was trying to implement, you know, they had some popular support, but they had a lot of opposition as well, and some of that was very highly represented in the Supreme Court.
And so, if we have, I mean, there seems to be like a sort of a factor X that has taken institutions that functioned inclusively up to, let's just say, for the sake of argument, 30 years, 20 years, wherever we peg it to. And it may be the rise of television, as you say, that increased the relevance of money. How do we, or whatever that X factor was that has changed how our government as an institution functions and is addressing the needs of a broader group of people, what can be done to reverse that? Is it, do we need to wait for another revolution, or do we need to wait for another group of politicians who come in and change this?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and let me start how I think is not what would I think would be a bad way of going about it. What you just said last would be a bad way of going about it. Doing nothing and wait for a politician who is just out of his or her volition going to change this. I think that's not going to happen, and because the politicians who are being elected are themselves the product of this system. So I think just hoping for some sort of enlightened leadership from a politician is not going to help. The second thing to note is that we have also recently had some major institutional changes, some major changes in the formal rules. You know, for example, Citizens United makes things worse because it allows money to pour even more freely into politics, and perhaps in an even more pernicious way into politics. So the first thing would be, of course, to reverse such things, you know, reverse Citizens United, reverse the ability of people to use lobbying and revolving door policies and campaign contributions. So those would be kind of rule changes, regulation changes that would help. But ultimately, the most important thing and the thing that should underpin such changes is that in exactly the same way as during the civil rights era, in exactly the same way as with the progressives and the populists, people need to be more engaged in politics. If you leave politics just to the politicians, the lobbyists, and the very, very wealthy who get to wine and dine with the politicians, we are bound to end up in this situation. So it's that the average American needs to become more engaged, not only in holding their congressmen and senators accountable, but in sort of making their voices heard. So in that sense, you know, you may disagree with the Occupy Wall Street movement, you know, you may complain about this tactic or that tactic, you can talk, you know, I'm an economist and I can point out that some of their economic rhetoric was not so perfect and so on and so forth, but be that as it may, you have to respect them because they are, what they are representing is this discontent with the politics as usual, and they have, you know, made big sacrifices to go out in the street in the cold and sometimes, you know, against sort of brutality from the police to actually go and make their voices heard. So in the same way, I would say, before it was entirely co-opted and taken over by the Republican Party, the Tea Party movement, you know, very ideologically very, very different, you know, totally different from Occupy Wall Street. You may disagree with their message and so on and so forth, but the fact that originally it started a little bit like a grassroots movement, people being unhappy and going in the street. That is sort of encouraging as well. That shows that American people are engaged in politics, and perhaps they will be more engaged in politics. And as they do so, that will, I think, be our best safeguard against the takeover of the political system by a narrow interest group.
And I don't want to hold you much longer, but I want to just extend this a little bit more. What is the dynamic that happens there? Because it seems to me, I mean, we know, for instance, we know that 70% of the population supports Medicare and Social Security, all right, by polling, mm-hmm. Give or take. Maybe it's a little bit more. We also know that recent reporting in the Washington Post, President Obama was about to trade cuts in Social Security for very anemic revenue. And even questionable amount, not even an amount, but the actual quality of the supposed revenue raised is even questionable. So is it when you talk about the importance of an Occupy Wall Street or any type of movement hitting the streets, is it because it's sending an implicit warning to the elite that essentially there's going to be destabilization, that ultimately,
absolutely,
if this continues,
absolutely,
it's, we're looking at a...
Absolutely. That's exactly it. It's a shock to the system. It's a message. And I think the more, and it works much better when the message is broader. I think it's not so effective when people just go on the street for something that just hurts them. So, for instance, in Nigeria, 2 weeks ago, we saw people pour into the streets because the oil subsidies were removed. You know, that was important, too, because people interpreted the oil subsidies being removed as more money is going to go into the hands of the politicians, and the politicians are corrupt, so that was part of their concern. But that's not a general, so it's still a narrow interest sort of issue. By a more general interest issue, I mean something like in Tahrir Square. When people in Egypt, you know, they rose up against the Hosni Mubarak's regime and the repressive rule of the security forces and the very corrupt regime, they didn't go there and say, we want more subsidies to food. That was an important thing. The food prices were increasing very rapidly in Egypt. They didn't say, you know, we want more jobs in government sector. They said, we want the political system to change. We want the corrupt politicians to go and political system to be more open, political parties to be open, the security services not to harass us anymore. So they really wanted a more comprehensive change in the system. And I think that's the sort of change that when people finally demand in a forceful manner, politicians will have to listen.
I think you're absolutely right on that, and I appreciate Darren Acemoglu, sorry.
That's okay.
But I'll get the book right. The Origins of Power, Prosperity, and Poverty, Why Nations Fail. We will have a link to this on majority.fm. It's a fascinating book, and I think the conclusions that it allows all of us to make in terms of what we need to do to get to make our institutions more inclusive and responsive, is, I think, our best chance of getting of seeing a broad-based prosperity. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Sam.